Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Have you figured out your ballot for the August 14th primary yet? No? Well, then stay tuned. Today on the show, we're going to help make sure you are better informed about your vote. Vermont Edition is doing interviews with candidates for statewide and federal office who are running in contested primaries. Today, we are sitting down with Dan Freilich. The medical doctor and Navy captain who lives in Brownsville is challenging incumbent Peter Welch for the Democratic nomination for U.S. House. Freilich ran as a Democrat, then as an independent in a Senate race against U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy in 2010. But today we're going to talk with him about why he wants to be Vermont's sole delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives. Dan Freilich, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Great to be back. Thank you.
One of the hallmarks of your campaign is the platform you're standing on of politics by the people, for the people. What does that mean?
It means that your representatives represent the people, and they endeavor to have one person, one vote, and that they have honor. They put public service in its truest form, i.e. putting other people ahead of themselves. And as professionals, as other professions are required, they do their best to minimize their conflicts of interest. And I think the best way that they can do that is to not take money from special interests so that they can give due process and that they can give all issues equal weight and all people equal weight without specific or increased access for some, but not for others.
Is that the main area of daylight you're trying to highlight between yourself and the incumbent Peter Welch?
No, it goes from A to Z. The problem is that the money corrupts everything. So no matter what topic we talk about, there is an enormous amount of daylight, to use your term, on the issues. But the essence of it is that the money causes a different way of addressing every issue.
So let's talk about then campaign finance reform and getting the money out of politics, and which you see as sort of a corrupting influence then in how somebody governs. What would you like to see in terms of how a candidate can raise money?
I think that step number one is to look at yourself, stop for a moment, look at your family, your friends, have a conversation and try to understand what morality is okay and what goes too far. I think, look, we've knocked on about 9,000 doors by now. Everybody says, why are you running? And I usually have the same line. It's usually, we are trying to propagate a movement of a standard of conduct for politicians, whereby they minimize their conflicts of interest and, as I mentioned before, be public servants. And I think that that is the sine qua non if you are going to successfully and transformationally actually address the true core issues. Back to Mr. Welch, I want to say up front in the beginning of this conversation, I don't think he's any worse than most congressmen there. Keyword, most. There are some who've stepped up to the plate and are actually leading and being role models, fighting cynicism, trying to sustain our democracy, and actually trying to get the money out of the process so that we can actually achieve some sort of equity for the core issues, which I'm sure we're going to talk about in a moment.
But you'd like candidates to voluntarily say, I'm not going to take any PAC money, as you have done.
Sure. I don't think it should even be a question. As a physician, I can certainly get rewards from pharmaceutical companies and then write prescriptions for them, but it's unethical. I wouldn't even ever think about doing such a thing. And the fact that it is legal and the fact that we as Democrats lament Citizens United and say we want to reverse it and all that kind of stuff, but take money at the same time, frankly, it's kind of deplorable. And I think it enormously contributes to people getting fed up with the Democratic Party, us losing elections, and to be a little bit more candid, probably is in part responsible for Trump's victory.
Now, your incumbent opponent, Peter Welch, says he too supports the idea of getting rid of PAC contributions, but until it is made illegal, then it would open up him or other candidates like you to having special interests on the Republican side, for example, come in and flood the campaign with money and make it harder for him or you to win an election. You don't buy that response?
No, of course not. It's very convenient, and I think it's kind of disingenuous. I don't think it's right. It's kind of like civil rights in the 60s, where some people remained racist even though the culture was changing and the Civil Rights Act eventually would make it illegal. So I think analogously, you can say that partaking in an unethical way of being a representative and raising money to be our one sole representative, waiting for Citizens United to make this kind of stuff illegal, I think is very, very low bar when it comes to integrity. Look, as I said, we've knocked on so many doors that I've gotten so many Vermont sort of inputs, and people are just really fed up with the process. I don't like using Trump's words because they're usually inaccurate, but the word swamp is probably appropriate. And the problem is it's not Mr. Welsh himself. It's him and anyone else who does the same thing that he's doing. They're part of the problem. They're part of the establishment and the status quo, and they're sort of stuck 10, 20 years behind. It's almost like Strom Thurmond, I don't know, throwing his fist down on a table, I am going to remain racist even though sort of it's left our culture.
And it's a strong analogy you're making from racism to PAC money.
Well, I think that PAC money is you're using a very tactical word, PAC money. I look at it as a conflict of interest in a public servant. And I guess as a military person, I find it kind of abominable. So I'm being a little bit strong and direct here. Because I want Mr. Welsh to step up to the plate and be a leader. And I said until now, as you know, it's been 6 months now that we've been stating over and over that I would withdraw from the election, freeze my campaign, get behind him and support him if he would do just one thing, and that's step up to the plate and stop taking the money. And he wouldn't be a lone person in the wilderness. As we know, Bernie and Elizabeth Warren kind of stopped doing this. Now Kirsten Gillibrand and Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke in Texas have announced that they're not taking either corporate money or PAC money more generally. He can be one of the first 10, 20, 30 and help Vermont, help America move forward, or we can be an anchor with some southern state. And I don't honestly prefer that.
I want to talk about other issues, but because this is one of the primary things that you're sort of coming out with in front as you talk to people and as you work on your campaign, if I could play devil's advocate for a moment to just say, you know, often people who are unlikely to raise as much money, partly because they're not as well known perhaps as the incumbent, might look at this idea of saying, well, if I could just get my opponent to not be able to raise as much money by vowing to do this thing that I also can't really do, then that would level the playing field. But this is you really make a point of this being a conviction rather than something for political expediency to try to make sure that you can raise a similar amount of money.
Jane, you and I had this conversation when I ran against Leahy. I've been at this for 10 years. I would much prefer to continue my naval career and my medical career, but I feel a commitment. Sort of unfairness, and when I see disingenuousness, this kind of thing really, really bothers me. That's why I got out of the Navy in terms of active duty and transferred to the reserve so I could run against Leahy when I did it back in 2010. And it's the same here. There is no political expedience. In fact, the expedience would be to remain as a physician. I love being a doctor. But I think that this is the underlying foundational problem of our governance. Most people think so.
Do you think you can win then, or are you taking this pause from your medical career to raise this issue fully expecting that you'll go back to it? I mean, do you really think that you'll win this election and head off to Congress?
So I think when we started the election, I gave myself a 10% chance. It was funny. My interns and myself, we sort of together made a prediction a few weeks ago. We thought 25 to 35%. I think it's every day getting higher. And I think serendipitously today is the day right after Ocasio-Cortez beat Crowley, who was maybe the fourth most powerful Democrat in Congress.
This is in a New York race.
The New York race. And, you know, he was, in quotes, an establishment strong Democrat, kind of liked in his district, somewhat akin to Mr. Welsh. But Ocasio-Cortez was a progressive. She ran on to his left. She fought for important issues like wealth inequality and single payer, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and pointed out very, very distinctly the conflicts of interest of the corporate money that he took, very much the same as Mr. Walsh's money.
So you see this as really energizing and buoying in terms of...
Oh, without question. And she had less than 10% of Crowley's money, probably similar to our situation.
In your campaign website, you say, quote, "The income tax is minimally progressive. Payroll and capital gains taxes are regressive. Estate tax is feeble and corporate tax loopholes are repugnant." What specific changes would you like to make to the tax structure in the United States?
Well, all of them. The first thing I would do is I would, if I had such power and tried to, if I win, I would try to team up with others to try to repeal Trump's tax bill, because that's completely cynical and completely regressive. So I wouldn't even discuss that, because first repeal it. But number one, I would like the income tax rates, the marginal rates, to be much higher, at least a 5% surcharge on people making at least $1 million. I would prefer marginal rates in the 50s, 60s, 70s if we can get away with it, but I would negotiate that. I would want the mortgage insurance deduction to be capped at around 28%, so that rich people don't get a bigger benefit than the middle class. I would want the payroll taxes be less regressive. As you know, Social Security for earned income ends at $120,000 or so. And then afterwards, rich people are home free. And that is absolutely ridiculous and cynical. And most people don't know it. There are no Social Security taxes on capital gains. We should apply those. Speaking of capital gains that are a much lower rate than earned income, and capital gains are the main income source for the wealthy. So I would equilibrate those two. The estate tax, I would bring the number down from what it used to be in $17-20 million. I'd bring it down to $2-3 million, so we reap a lot more of a reward. We're not a feudal state. We don't have aristocracies, and people need to earn their own income. It shouldn't be an heir kind of a thing. And then finally, with respect to corporate taxes, we as Democrats allowed the Republican Party to scam the American people into thinking that we have high corporate tax rates. Our statutory rate has been high, but our effective rate has been incredibly low. And that is such an important point that we Democrats allowed the Republican Party to own. And Mr. Welch doesn't make a big deal out of it. So we definitely need to do that. We need to get rid of delayed repatriation and all the reasons that corporations move money overseas and never pay their taxes.
What about on health care? You're running on a Medicare for all, single-payer, universal health care approach here. Hasn't worked yet. Didn't work for Vermont when we tried to go to a single-payer approach. What makes you think you could make it work?
Well, first of all, it's not that it didn't work.
It was abandoned by the main proponent of it, who staked his entire political career, one could argue, sure, on making sure that it worked.
First of all, single-payer in a state is very different nationally. And I say that up front because you still have a multi-payer system, because you have to deal with 49 other states and territories. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, it was given up partly, in my opinion, mainly for political reasons in 2014, which Mr. Shumlin was not necessarily willing to make the argument that we're going to have to raise payroll and other taxes. But of course, your premiums would go down. So on balance, you'd make more money. I mean, you save money, each individual Vermonter.
But although that wasn't what the studies found, at least in the first few years.
My reading is that there were savings of about $400 per capita per person. When you do it nationally, you save about $4,000 to $5,000 per capita, which of course is much bigger because you get rid of all the administrative costs that you don't necessarily get rid of with Green Mountain Care. Why do I think single payer is the right way to do it? I think it's the most equitable and moral way to do it, because obviously, by definition, you get universal health care. All the economic studies show that you save $400 to $600 billion, mainly in administrative costs, but also in terms of pharmaceutical costs. The average American would save $4,000 or so a year. The final point about this is I love when Trump, for example, refers to tariffs being his way of trying to compete. The best thing that America can do in order to compete with selling, manufacturing, and other stuff is to get the yoke, the anchor of health insurance off businesses' neck. People can't move. I mean, it's what's called job lock. They keep jobs that are not enjoyable, they're not proficient at, that are not efficient for their career, just because of health insurance. That also is something that would be solved if we switched to a single-payer system.
We don't know yet what's going to happen. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the blue wave. There's a lot of talk of Democrats being able to take back Congress. But we don't know what's going to happen in 2018. If you were elected and there's still a Republican majority in Congress, how would you work on these priorities and work with Republicans to try to get any of them passed, since you're, you know, leaning on the progressive side and your colleagues across the aisle may disagree strongly?
I'm sure they will. First of all, I think Republicans should be for single payer as much as anybody, for the business reasons that I just alluded to a moment ago.
So you try to be persuasive.
try to be persuasive, remind them that I'm a naval officer, and maybe they'll actually be willing to talk to a military progressive, because there aren't many of us. But I do feel that not taking special interest money, to come back to the first topic we discussed, gives you a moral power that allows you to sit down and negotiate, sort of like Tip O'Neill style in the olden days, where you can actually get along, you trust each other, you assume that the convictions are based on what you actually think as opposed to who is giving you money. And I think I'll be able to be pretty effective. Look, the majority of Americans support single payer right now. Mr. Welch says he supports it, although I can't find a word about it on his website. And which is part of my problem with the establishment. And again, I'm going to sort of take away Mr. Welch and be more broad and say establishment part component of the Democratic Party. It is very safe. It's very unexciting. It's kind of boring. It's 10 to 20 years behind. It certainly does nothing to raise the interest of young voters. Just saying that you kind of support single payer but not fighting for it with an avidity that creates enthusiasm, energy, and more importantly, gets other people to join you so you can actually pass some legislation eventually.
Anna is calling in from Brandon. Hi, Anna. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling to Dan. Vermont has become, I think, one of the least friendly business states in the country. And it's crazy to hear that he wants to add all these taxes to these millionaires who bring jobs. I mean, it's crazy. Is he nuts? Has he looked around? Do you know, in Rutland, Vermont, to own a house, it costs you $5,000 a year just in taxes. Just in taxes. Nothing else. It's crazy. We need to bring in businesses. We don't need to be charging them more money to go out of state. Vermont is dying. I mean, we need good jobs. We need industry. We don't need anybody pushing them out.
Anna, I hear you. And let's put that right to Dan Frylock. Here's Anna saying, don't tax businesses more.
Well, Anna, thanks for the call. And I concur and I sort of empathize with your concern about business viability in Vermont. To be fair, I am advocating much higher taxes on the wealthy and on corporations federally, which is even in each state. So the contention that people will leave Vermont to go to New York or wherever, I don't think is accurate for what I'm reflecting.
Would they leave Vermont to go to a different country?
Well, I don't think so. I think that when the wealthy do not create jobs and they don't stimulate the economy. They put their money away typically, often don't pay taxes on their capital gains for 1,000 reasons. The middle class, when they have money, they spend it all because they don't usually have that much to save in the first place. And that's what stimulates the economy and creates jobs enthusiasm within the economy. Having said that, to come back to your question, I do think that we have a problem in Vermont that we don't actually do anything on a systematic level, in my opinion, to invigorate and to maintain our economy at its highest levels. For example, what one has to do is say, what is our strengths? And our strengths, certainly we cannot compete with some of the huge cities. We just don't have the populace. So what are our strengths? When one laments our property taxes and say that they're too high, in fact, you have to turn that around and say to yourself, well, maybe actually that is a positive because it means that we have incredible schools and that's why our property taxes are high.
I just want to jump in here also to clarify, to make sure that we're all on the same page, that property taxes and federal taxes are different. Property taxes are not levied by the federal government.
At all.
So whether a corporation is taxed a different rate on federal taxes, they're all connected, Anna, I get it, but it's not the same thing as how much you're paying in your property taxes.
Right, and I think these are completely separate issues. I was just alluding to the fact
go on.
The way I feel as congressman, or I wish Mr. Welch would do the same, is that the way we would increase the viability of our economy is to maximize our strengths. One of them would be, for example, to be the most proactive, tip-of-the-spear political state in the country by, for example, being the only state where we simply do not take special interests by our federal delegation. That would get around. People would think that's amazing, and it would be one reason that young couples and families might decide to move in. That unto itself, probably not. But now let's add a few other things. If we were the first state to manage to get single payer, even though we haven't gotten it federally yet, that would be the other kind of thing, which that kind of a safety net would be kind of amazing for young, intelligent couples who will want to move in and who are thinking, and that would help the viability of the economy. The same thing with green energy. I think we have goals for carbon emissions, but we don't actually have statute. Imagine if we were the state that by statute declared we'll be carbon free by year blank. In fact, pick California and then go 1 year ahead of them and let's just beat them. And again, you advertise that too. It's sort of like a Virginia is for lovers, but a Vermont is for thinkers kind of an advertisement.
And why aren't you running for governor?
I was asked to by a lot of people, but I chose not to. I'm trying to change the system. As you know, my slogan is reclaim the Democratic heart and soul. I kind of feel that the Democratic Party on a national level is the only one that has the sufficient power to theoretically, keyword theoretically, make transformational change towards equity so that there could be equitable pursuit of happiness for all Americans. But we need to fix the party first.
Let me ask you about a couple of specific issues. Right now the country is really consumed with this question about children who are being taken from their parents when their parents are crossing the southern border illegally. And the Trump administration has announced that this policy will end. But there's still a lot of uncertainty over what's going to happen there. Also today, the House is voting on a GOP-led bill on immigration, and it incorporates a lot of things. It talks about this policy of separating children. It would end that policy of separating children in a legislative way. It would also give $25 billion for a border wall. It would reduce legal immigration numbers, and it would offer a path to citizenship for the young people who are often known as the Dreamers. Would you be voting in favor of that bill today or
against
it?
No, I wouldn't, although the last phrase I support, citizenship for Dreamers, obviously. And a path for other undocumented immigrants. I would not spend a penny on a wall. Where we should be spending our pennies, obviously, are in trying to figure out sort of an enlightened security, why this is happening in first place. The countries that most of the immigrants are emanating from have horrific issues, and that money could be spent trying to help their economies to revamp and that always works. Stop it at the source in a good, benevolent, fair way rather than doing evil things such as separating children. Look, I'm reading Madeleine Albright's fascism book right now. The associations are very, very close. This is another issue where I am pretty vehemently in disagreement with Mr. Welch. Mr. Welch voted, for example, against the Mr. Green, who is the congressman from Texas, his impeachment bill back in December. I think that there is more than ample evidence to support impeachment, and it's kind of back to leadership and being exciting and fighting for something as opposed to sitting and compromising, always being politically expedient, waiting and being safe. The abuse of power, the obstruction of justice, the emoluments problems. There are so many reasons why we have met all the constitutional criteria for impeachment, even if we're not necessarily going to win. Just step number one, maybe you'll get 50 votes. Maybe the second time you'll get 80 votes. But you put the president on watch.
So you would support impeachment proceedings?
Not only would support, I actively will pursue working with colleagues if I do get elected to impeach Mr. Trump as soon as possible.
You mentioned you wouldn't spend a penny on a border wall. Some Democrats have been willing to essentially say, I'm holding my nose, I'm supporting a border wall in order to get these other concessions from Republicans, including a path to citizenship for the Dreamers. That's not something that you would do? You wouldn't make that compromise?
I'll spend a dime.
But no, you wouldn't compromise.
No, I would not. No.
When you talk about your opponent, you mispronounce his name. And I'm curious if you're doing that on purpose as a political strategy.
No. If I did, that was inadvertent.
When you call him Welch instead of Welch. That's not a strategy.
Of course not.
Okay. We got a note from Julie in Argyle, New York, who wants to know why you would want or would you want a federal minimum wage? She says the minimum wage should be adjusted for the cost of living in different areas of the country. For instance, the cost of living in San Francisco is much different than in Paulette, Vermont. Would you support a federal minimum wage, and would it be a tiered wage, as she suggested?
No, it wouldn't be tiered. And it would go much higher than that. It should be a federal minimum livable wage, back to equitable pursuit of happiness and equal opportunity and due process for all. And a minimum income is needed in order to have all that. We had a revolution for a reason. We wrote a declaration with an intent of what our country would look like. But I should say that when Democrats put all their hat into the minimum wage, I think that's an incredible minimum. And obviously what we really should be concentrating on, of course we should do that.
Would you have a number?
Yeah, 20.
20 would be your number.
Correct.
Okay.
Obviously, it's negotiable, but that kind of number. But I think return to progressive taxation, like what we talked about earlier, is much. It's a much bigger effect, and it's actually much more important. But both should be done.
What's your position on firearms restrictions and what you would do at a federal level in terms of gun control?
So if you looked, I bet you looked at my website, I'm pretty direct in terms of comprehensive gun control approaches. There's no mincing words. There's no milk toasting because I'm worried about pissing off some gun lobby or some so-called heritage. We do have a heritage, and I respect that. But I don't respect free. Nothing is free. We can't say fire, you know, scream fire in a movie theater. There are always limits to all rights. Having said that, A, I don't take money from NRA, unlike my opponent. B, I think when one doesn't take money, one can sit and negotiate with your opponent. And those who are for gun rights, I have my position. It's very clear, as you said. For example, no assault weapon bans, high
capacity. Yes, assault weapon bans.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, sorry. High-grade magazine ban, long waiting periods. So, of course, background checks that are universal. But I'm willing to negotiate just like anything else.
I assume you've been trained in firearms as a naval officer.
Yes.
Do you carry a weapon now? Are you comfortable talking about your relationship, your personal relationship?
Sure,
to guns?
I've been trained. I have a ribbon. I've trained in M16s and M9s, but I don't carry a weapon.
We got a note from Shanna who says, can you ask Dr. Dan about his policies regarding family leave and child care? This is one of the biggest challenges for Vermonters.
So as a Democrat, of course, I support family leave and child care, and we need to put a ton of money in it to even somewhat equilibrate with other democracies. This is pretty standard, but all Democrat politicians say that. The question is where you're going to get the money to do that. That comes back to fighting for progressive taxation. So you have to say, we're going to raise the taxes on the wealthy, we're going to raise the taxes on tax-evading corporations, and then you have money for revenue. It's the same thing like when Bernie Sanders, during the presidential election, said that one of his positions was free higher public education in public schools. And I think that's fantastic, and I'm completely supportive of that. I want to say that I'm completely supportive of free higher education, college education, and public schools. It costs about $45 billion, which sounds a lot of money. It's actually not if the wealthy and the corporations paid what they always paid back in most of the 20th century. That would bring in about $700 billion in revenue. And that's when you can start accomplishing the kind of social and important social goods that, for example, that this person who asked your question about.
So in terms of paid family leave, if you're raising revenue at the federal level and assuming that there would be some sort of paid family leave for people when they have a baby or adopt a baby, et cetera, that would come from the federal coffers. There would be – you wouldn't require
sure.
companies to pay paid
no,
block, leave.
No, block grants. It would be via taxes. I mean, it would be tax deductions or tax
And in terms of child care, would you essentially nationalize child care and have subsidized child care for people in the United States?
I think it would be completely tax deductible, and it would be for those who don't pay taxes, one would actually get tax credits. That would be the way the federal government would return the money.
We got a note from Citizen Jones who says, one very senior Vermont congressional delegation, or rather our very senior Vermont congressional delegation, and most of the state's top politicians have locked arms and claimed their hands are tied in influencing the basing decision for the F-35 at the Burlington International Airport. Their mantra is that it's a done deal, even though there's a lot of local opposition. What's your position, and what would you do differently from Representative Welch?
I would not take money from all the corporations in the arms industry that support basing of the F-35 because they have a profit reason to do so. I am not taking a big position on F-35 because I can see both sides to the story, but I can see both sides to the story very objectively without taking money like Welch and Leahy have done. So I can understand them taking a position, whatever it is, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but I don't like, and I think it's completely unethical that they are taking a position publicly while taking money from all these corporations. I am going to focus on four issues. I'm going to focus on campaign finance reform, wealth inequality, Medicare for all, and green transformation of the economy. I'm not going to have distractions from taking money from other corporations, and I'm not going to have distractions from spending time trying to get that money, and I'm not going to have distractions from these core issues.
And you think you said I'm just trying to get you locked down here, Dan, because you said 25-30%, but now you're thinking you could actually win the nomination. So your own estimation of what kind of vote tabulation you could get is changing by the day as you look at what's happening in other states.
Correct. And I think it's almost a flip of a coin. I'm not unrealistic. I know it's difficult to take down, so to speak, an incumbent and send him to retirement. Retirement would probably be very pleasant for him. But on a serious note, yes, I think there's a very good chance that we'll be able to win this. Certainly, it's hard. I don't say that. You know, we didn't mention at all anything about – it's just difficult. We have a bubble in Vermont about we're beautiful and we're accepting and we treat others with respect. But sometimes our assumption of goodness in others gets taken to an extreme so that we actually sweep things under the rug. And the way Mr. Welsh has been representing us, claiming to be a progressive but taking all this corporate money that precludes him from actually being a progressive is pretty disingenuous, maybe a scam at most.
That's Dan Frylich challenging incumbent Peter Welch for the Democratic nomination for Vermont's sole seat in the U.S. House. He's a medical doctor and Navy captain. The third contender in that race is Ben Mitchell. And you can hear our interview last week with Ben Mitchell by going to VPR.net. Dan Frylich, thank you very much for talking with us today. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome.